Atlanta. And no matter where you go, everywhere we go, we figure out how to feed ourselves. Tuck in.
Have a banana, Anna. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it to Gravy Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Try a tomato, please, too. Here's Cacciatore, Dory. Taste of bologna, Tony. Everybody eats when they come to my house. I fix your favorite dishes. Hoping this good food fills ya. Work my hands to the bone in the kitchen alone. You better eat if it kills ya. Pass me a pancake mandrake. Having a derby irby. Look in the fendel mandel. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Hannah, Davy, Tommy, Dora, Andrew. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Pasta fazula, Tulula. Oh, do have a bagel, bagel. Now don't be so bashful, Nashville. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Hey, this is a party, Marty. There, you get the cherry, Jerry. Now look, don't be so picky, Mickey. Cause everybody eats when they come to my house. All of my friends are welcome. Don't make me coax you, moax you. Eat the tables, the chairs, the napkins, who cares? You gotta eat if it chokes you. Oh, do have a knish, knishia. Pass him the latke, matke. Chili con carne for Barney. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Face, Buster, Chef, Chops, Funk. Everybody eats when they come to my house.
We'll set the table for today's show with Bernadine Jocelyn and Dennis Goychuk. Bernadine honors her Scandinavian heritage in her cooking. Dennis is from Ukraine and the same honors his heritage. We'll start with Dennis.
I come from Ukraine, and about dishes, it was always part of both culture and my childhood upbringing. I remember myself being like a 7-year-old kid and waking up in the middle of the night coming to kitchen in a long, dark Soviet highway, and my grandma was there always making something for the whole family. It was about hospitality. She was always there making something. And I guess my memory is just, it was always big breakfasts, and it was always the same because of the food scarcity and, you know, limited amount of recipes that she could make, and she was always trying to make something. So one of them was big barley dishes, sometimes with eggs, sometimes with some version of cheap pancakes, and she was always trying to make a lot of them because she never knew who would show up in the morning, and it was a big family, and we had many grandchildren running around different times of the day, and she had to feed us in between of thinking how to take care of the rest of the her, you know, livestock, and so she was kind of built into the thing, and yeah, it was like a pretty memorable experience. I really like the crepes, I guess the word, yes. And then, yeah, so with the, usually it's done with the farmer's cheese or jam or something like that. Blinchiki. Mm-hmm.
Which means little blinny. Blinchiki, little blinny.
I guess breakfast was always a family-defining event, cultural event, because everybody was, made sometimes different times, because everybody had different responsibilities, but it was getting together in the morning and kind of checking in for the day and see what's going on. So it was a big part of the day.
So my father's mother, Helene Jocelyn, was a newspaper reporter, which was unusual for her day to have a profession like that. And towards the end of her life, she was no longer actively reporting. She was working for what they called a clipping service. Can you imagine what that is? Back in the day before the internet, her job was to read a whole bunch of newspapers, and then she had a client list of people that were interested in, you know, sports or whatever it is, and she would keep that in her head and then clip out articles for each of those clients. And she had 5 days of vacation a year. And she would religiously take one day off every December to make these brown cookies, she called them. We called them Grandma Helene cookies, but she called them brown cookies. And the recipe that I've inherited from her for those cookies includes 10 pounds of flour, an enormous bowl of batter, and it would take her the whole day. She took off that whole day because she would, and I don't know how the heck she was able to mix that batter. I mean, I've got a huge electric mixer and I can barely manage it. She would make hundreds of cookies. And then she didn't even have a cookie cutter. I use a cookie cutter for them, shape of a Christmas tree. But she would just cut with a knife. So there were these awkward, oblong, very, very unattractive cookies, just brown cookies, but special. They were made with sorghum and citron and toothsome cookies. She was very frugal, and in those days it cost money to make a long distance call. And she would call us long distance to tell us that she had made her way to the Greyhound bus depot with our box of cookies, with our Christmas box, and to make sure that we would be there at the Greyhound bus in downtown Minneapolis to pick up those Grandma Helene cookies. And then that tradition of making Christmas cookies, I think my mother kind of evolved into an annual Christmas cookie plate extravaganza. And she would make a dozen kinds of Christmas cookies. Not only Grandma Helene's, which took a whole day, but many others as well. And then on Christmas morning, we would spread those tins out in the dining room, on the dining room table, and assemble cookie plates. And every cookie plate had one or two, depending on the kind of cookie, of each cookie. And then, of course, some nuts in their shell and a little piece of candy. And she'd tie each one up with a red yarn and a little sprig of pine and a candy cane. And then in the Christmas morning, we would stand in the dining room while the nine carols played. That was always a big part of our tradition, the nine lessons and carols from King James Chapel. And then she'd send the kids out, us kids out, to hand deliver to the neighbors. We didn't know our neighbors except for these cookie deliveries, so they anticipated us every year. And then we would also bundle ourselves up in the car, the old station wagon, the whole family, all our big bodies in there, each with cookies on our lap, and drive around and deliver these cookies Christmas Eve. And this year I have made cookie plates, over a couple dozen, that we'll be delivering the next couple days.
For Ukrainian tradition, the New Year's and Christmas are the biggest holidays. And we don't actually make that many cookies. So when I came here, the whole cookie tradition became a whole new reality for me. And in Ukrainian and post-Soviet culture, the main thing is you put on the Christmas and New Year's table is salads. I'm really enjoying making these salads, trying to remember my grandma's recipes. One of them is quite famous. It's called quite famous in the setting where I come from. The name of it says herring under a furry coat. It's probably my favorite dish for the New Year's. It's called, in Russian, it's called shuba. It's a pretty funny name, but which actually means, and the reason why it's called that is just because it's a layered salad, so it has six different layers. So the furry coat just comes from that understanding. It's a, you know, it has layers and it's thick, and it has six main ingredients. It has, in certain ways, you put the layers of herring, onions, potatoes, carrots, eggs, and then boiled beets. And then you mix it with a special recipe of sauce, which has mayo and some sour cream and stuff like that. It's a pretty interesting, actually, thing because it's six layers, but it's pretty amazing how many infinite designs you can have how to put those layers in the salad, and every person has its own opinion. And in fact, even I, when I mix them every year, I change them because there's a belief that affects the taste and such. So
if I can offer, this year Dennis comes to me and he goes, this year our shuba doesn't have the mashed potatoes on the bottom. It has on the second layer from the bottom, because I studied last year and I decided this year the order of the layers is different.
Be different. And potato is never a second layer, it's a third layer. Onion goes second.
Thanks to Bernadine Jocelyn and Dennis Goychuk. Coming up, a bowl of borscht. But first, here's Daka Braka from Ukraine. Michael Goldberg. Today on Stay Human, some stories I think of as bowls because they all contain food and give it a shape. Shape is another word for meaning, and our stories give the food meaning, and our food contains the stories. I thought about this when my friend Sam Miltich told me he had learned something important from making beet soup, borscht.
I wasn't actually making borscht at that point. I was actually in the garden. I was tending the plants that would become borscht. And I always grow a lot of beets because I'm just thinking about the fall coming up, and I like that good shot of iron into the blood system before winter. So I'm working on my 10 acres of land and feeling very fortunate that I have 10 acres of land to have a nice big garden, right? The backstory is I had grown up with this thought that I was half Norwegian and essentially half Croatian, which was really not the case. It was a far more complex story than that. There was a branch of my dad's mother's family that we had always not known. We didn't know anything about it. So the reason I got into genealogy was not the knowns, it was the unknowns. And then a bunch of other sidetracks came as a result of this research, which I didn't even come close to anticipating. The only thing we knew about these people was that they had come from Alsace-Lorraine. And that was it. We didn't even know the surname necessarily. So the family name that we did know was Geno, is how we pronounced it. And in my ignorance, I didn't realize that in Poland, the W is a V, and that the family name is actually Gianov, which is probably shortened from Gianowski. And what we also didn't know was that the people from Alsace-Lorraine were part Sephardic Jewish. So that was kind of a remarkable find. My paternal grandmother, my dad's mom. So when I started looking at the records, everything I was looking at was in Poland. And I had heard nothing about Poland over the course of our life. Absolutely nothing. Maybe Germany I had heard this Alsace-Lorraine piece, and this name, we pronounced it Geno, G-E-N-O-W, and my dad thought, well, you know, it's close to France, maybe it's Genoa or something like this. Well, no, the family was Polish, the name was pronounced Genov, and probably shortened from Genovsky. So they were Polish and Ukrainian on that side, that came from near Krakow towards the Ukrainian border. They married into a family from Alsace-Lorraine that had migrated to Poland from Alsace-Lorraine, and I asked myself, why do people from Alsace-Lorraine go to Poland? They're Jewish, is why they go to Poland, like so many other Jews. And this was such a mind-shifting event that I actually had professional genealogists check my work. So these were Sephardic Jews that were sort of assimilated into French-German culture in Alsace-Lorraine that were probably living an Ashkenazi life because of their neighbors that they joined into that tribe, so to speak. So anyways, they converge in Poland. They get married. We don't know exactly the origins of them because there's a partition of Poland where Russia takes the east, Germany takes the west, Austria-Hungary takes the south. And the family story is lost. So anyways, I found this out over the course of the last 2 years I began this study. And so, you know, I've eaten borscht my whole life, and this gives a whole new meaning to borscht for me, you know? So here's the deal. I'm out in the garden, and I'm hoeing away. I'm thinking about owning land, and I'm thinking about what it means to not own land. And I think, okay, well, the Genovskis are part Ukrainian. The Schutz-Kramer family is Jewish. What's the difference here between the Jewish borscht and the Ukrainian borscht? And I realize, wait a minute, you know, the Jewish borscht is vegetarian. The Ukrainian borscht has beef in it. And I'm thinking, I want to make an Ashkenazi borscht. And I thought, I don't even know how to do this without a piece of meat, you know, because I usually start out by boiling a soup bone. And you get all that nice marrow in there and make a delicious broth. So one of the things that occurred to me, you know, we have these Cossack genetics that are part of the Ukrainian mix. And I thought to myself, well, you know, the Cossack, the Tsar comes up to him and says, I'm going to grant you some land in exchange for some military service. You're going to keep us safe from the Ottoman Turks who are coming up the Black Sea. You're going to get however many hectares. So the Cossack says, that's great. I can have a herd of cattle out there. I can have some cows. I can have some pigs. I can have some sheep. And so he has access to meat. Not only does he have more than one cow, those cows are having calves, so it's a full herd. So he can slaughter the extra cattle. So he has some nice beef bones that he can boil. He's got meat that he can put into his borscht. Now, the Schutz-Kramer family, the Jewish family who's living in Poland, they live in a shtetl. They don't have a piece of land. What kind of meat is available to them? Well, it's probably going to be chicken, because chickens feed themselves. It might be some geese, because they eat grass. The other part of it is you're not going to mix meat and milk. So those geese and chickens, there's some wonderful schmaltz that you get out of the deal for your mixing your matzo balls and making your soup. And so it's the combination of those who have land and those that don't. As far as the cow goes, I thought of Tevye on Fiddler on the Roof, right? And when you have just one cow in your shtetl, are you going to butcher that cow for a bowl of borscht? No. But the cow, in order to give milk, is going to have a calf. So Passover, you can have brisket. You know, like once a year, you get this wonderful meal of brisket from the calf that's born. And the reason you don't slaughter the cow is it's going to give you fat. It's going to give you milk, which equals cream, which equals something even better, which is sour cream. And the fat doesn't come from the bone or the meat of the cow. It comes from that wonderful sour cream, which is a big dollop. You've solved the problem. There's no meat and milk. And there's my borscht story. The most important thing as far as making the various different kinds of borscht, to me, this is the defining factor of borscht, is it's a sweet and sour soup. So what I always do is I boil up 4 or 5 beets, and I boil them for an hour with the skin on. Then I slip the skins off, and I julienne them, and I create the broth. But I leave one beet as a raw beet, and I peel it like a carrot with a peeler, and I grate it, and then I take a ladle full of the soup from the pot, and I put it into that grated beet, and then I put a teaspoon of sugar, and then I put a couple teaspoons of white vinegar in it, and I let that simmer a little bit, and then I add the vinegar and sugar into the borscht. And to me, without that, it doesn't work. You know, it doesn't work. It has to have that sweet and sour flavor. So to me, that's the defining factor. That's what's got to happen. Whether it's with meat or it's vegetarian, you got to have that sweet sour vinegar flavor in it. Like so many other great, you know, Eastern European foods, pickled beets, you know, cucumber pickles, on and on. It's that sweet and sour is just like essential.
Mm-hmm. Do you think practically every dish has an economic, social, cultural history?
Absolutely. It has to, because every dish is connected to the earth, and it's the relationship to the earth and how we as humans have related to it for eons. You know, I think about my Croatian side, which, you know, I know much more about that. You know, it's fish and it's lamb. You know, you're not going to be able to have a cow in this rocky landscape of the Balkan Peninsula. You have these goats and these lambs that clamber up the rocky hillsides and the mountains, and they can feed themselves. And, you know, a readily available source of protein is going to come from the sea. And my dad's dad, who lived in Dalmatia, we call ourselves Dalmatinots, which is the Croats from the coast of the Adriatic. It's very Mediterranean, and his phrase was the sea was our garden. So in terms of how that carries forward, my grandpa and my great-grandpa were like serious fishermen in Minnesota. Like, walleyes were king. But I remember when we went over there in April, there's this fish called an orada. And I looked it up, and I wanted to know what family it's from. It's from the bream family. So bluegills and sunfish in Minnesota are from the bream family. They're freshwater bream, which explained a lot, because my grandpa Andy in Virginia, like, sunfish were like super important to him. And the way he cooked them was he just took out the gills, he gutted them and scaled them, and they were eaten whole, which is exactly the way we ate fish in Dalmatia. I mean, it's just exactly cooked the same way. So like sunfish were like, you know, sunfish and walleyes were like serious table fare, and they made a fish soup called brudet, but the same as the borscht. What makes that soup what it is? It was vinegar. And the vinegar goes into the pot, and it keeps the fish from falling apart. It kind of firms up the flesh and stuff. So, you know, it's always connected to the land. There's always a cultural connection. And I remember hearing an Anishinaabe person from Red Lake, and they said, you know, why do we live in Minnesota where we live? If you have a rice field, if you have walleyes, and if you have sugar, you have calories, you have carbohydrates, you have protein, it's going to keep you alive. So why do we put our villages, and that goes for all of us, all across the globe, so we can eat?
Thanks to Sam Miltich.
Я хочу спеть песню Ефима Черного на стихи Мейера Хараца из репертуара Адрианы Кубер, которую мы все любим и помним. Эта песня называется «Борщ». Это идышская песня, но не тот борщ, который мы все знаем, а тот борщ, который мы все тоже знаем. А веселый борщ мы троит, он на веселый эринг мы кроит, на веселый эпис мы завававававалт, он на веселый кашу мы шмалт, на келлер локс мы кьёйх, он ксиме са веселый ой. Возик мы курцен меню, башерен с готынью, ябабай, ябабабай, ябабибабибабабабай. Ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой-ой
die schöne Fisch, bei Scheren sah Gast zum Tisch. Ai, ja, ba, ba, ja, ba, ba, ba. Na, ja, ba, bi, bo, ba, 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 ba. Ai, ja, ba, 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 ba. Манты, кельбаса, манго, ласси, браун, райсы, чучвара узбекская, такая штука, много лука, жареное тесто, соус, песто. Еще имеет место каперинья, ром, кашаса, бочка кваса, водка, чай, sophisticated drink, махитн, general, salt chicken, уной, халяска, роун, кока-колн, равиолн, тирамисн, моцареун, кушайте, брателн, чтоб вы были все здоровы, как коровы, и на гутер шоу. Я ва-ва-ва-ва-ва-ва-вай, она веселая, каша мед кой. Und da sieht ein kurzen Menü. Bescher uns Gott ein Jo.
My thanks to Sam Miltich for his borscht. Borscht was a staple at my grandparents' house when I was growing up. And every time that we sat down to it, my grandpa said, "You can't beat borscht." But until Sam told me about the Cossacks' version of borscht, I had never heard of it ever having meat. Now I know why I'd never heard that. I've learned plenty from Sam over the years. In addition to being my neighbor in Wabana Township, he and his family are part of my chabura. That's the Hebrew word for the expanded family of choice, people who observe the Jewish holidays together. It's a special kind of relationship sustained through the decades and through the generations. The babies and the children all now have their own growing children, so year to year we gather in an ever-growing group. Our recent Hanukkah party was only 6 kids and 10 adults, all glad to be there. We said the blessings, lit the candles, and later on we passed out chocolate wrapped to look like gold coins for the kinder. But first, with gusto and with applesauce, we ate dozens of latkes, many of them made from potatoes out of Sam Miltich's garden, a special variety he's cultivated. He calls them Yukon Goldbergs. For such a big group, I start cooking them 3 or 4 weeks in advance, some to store in the freezer, the last few dozen in the refrigerator. Cooking them is a thing, oil everywhere and general mess. But doing it this way, the kitchen is clean before the party. And the halatkas have so much oil in them, a hot oven brings them quickly ready for table, platter after platter. Every ritual collapses the present into the past, and the past into an eternal present. Long after the night's Hanukkah candles have burned down, the glow remains, and there's a few latkes left over, too, for tomorrow. Shalom, my friends. Peace be with you. Klezmer music from Zev Feldman. You are tuned to our weekly mix of words and music, Stay Human, on KAXE KBXE, streaming at KAXE.org. It's people-powered radio, and we're supported by the folks who listen to it. If you think it's worthwhile to keep it going, please join us anytime at kaxc.org. Today's show is about some of the meanings behind how we feed ourselves. I got the idea for it when I heard our next teller talk about his work to help feed the members of his community.
My name's Foster Kanoyer Hogan. I am Sichangu Lakota, a tribal citizen of the Rosebud Sioux tribe. And I live on the reservation, and I am the bison coordinator at Indian Collective. My role and the work that I get to do, it's pretty awesome, honestly. My journey with bison started about 7-ish years ago, mostly with cooking. My background is in like farm to school, a little bit of nutrition, but mostly within the realm of indigenous food sovereignty. And so it taught me a lot about my own culture, my language, etc., and also the importance of bison as a keystone species for our traditional territories, our treaty territories. And so when all of this chaos was happening with the government shutdown and the SNAP benefits being paused, that created a lot of uncertainty, fear, chaos, etc., all these feelings and emotions. Because for my tribe, our landmass is larger than the state of Delaware, and over half of our tribal citizens that live on reservation utilize SNAP benefits. And a lot of those are children under the age of 18. That shows kind of where we're at as a nation with regard to our food systems. And it's by design, you know, across Indian country, all the tribes, all the reservations, they're food apartheids, imposed systems that we didn't ask for. And you can trace it back in history for the Lakota, for the Great Plains tribes. It goes back to the 1800s when the U.S. government and the military intentionally sought to destroy our food systems by killing the bison. They knew the importance of bison to us, that it was our staple source of protein meat, what it meant to us culturally and spiritually. And it was Colonel Dodge during the Black Hills exploration. He said, "Kill them all. Every buffalo dead is an Indian gone." That was their mentality. That was the order to shoot all the buffalo for game. That was kind of a pivotal moment in our history because that shifted the paradigm for our food systems. That with boarding schools, displacement, you know, reservations, the ration system, etc., all of those in conjunction with each other really just set us back. And so fast forward to today, that's why we are food insecure. We're not food sovereign. And so when that happened, a lot of tribes, nonprofits, grassroots, just community leaders, everyone stepped up. And it was very fascinating to me to see how many entities and individuals stepped up for bison. Because as you know, South Dakota is big in cattle and beef industry. And that really struck me. I was like, this is really awesome to see how much bison is being promoted, how much is being done working with our bison relatives. That's what they are. They're relatives to us. They're not domesticated animals, nothing like that. And so what we did at Indian Collective, our headquarters is based in Rapid City, South Dakota. And there's a huge native population there within the area. And so we started a campaign called Feed the People. And it was a response to the SNAP crisis. We didn't want our people to go hungry. And we raised money to purchase buffalo meat from Sacred Storm Buffalo, which is a native bison meat processing unit but also a storefront right there in Rapid City. So we purchased meat from them, about 5,000 pounds worth, and assembled boxes. And in the boxes was 10 pounds of ground bison meat and 2 pounds of stew meat. And we distributed that to 456 families. Each family got one box. And also in the box, it shared a little bit about why bison is important, not only for us culturally, but what it does for the earth, the aerated soil, carbon storing, et cetera. You know, all these different fun facts. And also shared two simple recipes. You know, we preach indigenous food sovereignty and being sustainable. But with that dismantling of our food systems, it's really surprising how many people don't really know how to cook. And the way processed foods is pushed at people, you know, convenience is the thing now. And so we shared two simple recipes that they can use their bison meat. Very simple, very modern. I like to say go low and slow because it's very lean. It doesn't have a lot of fat on it. So cooking it at a medium high temp like you would beef is going to burn it. It's going to make it tough. And so I just like to just take a roast, put it in a crock pot, low and slow for like 8 to 10 hours. Start in the morning, you'll be ready by dinner. It's nice and tender and it's pulling apart and it's pretty versatile. You can use it for sandwiches, soup. And so we wanted to showcase like, this is a food security moment, but it's going to have an impact further along in our food system. This is why bison restoration is important. This is why land back is important, because the bison need land to roam, do what they do as land stewards. And in turn, they're going to take care of us by providing us with adequate nutrition from their meat, their bone marrow, everything. And then that doesn't include what they do for us culturally and spiritually as well. And so it's a pretty big, big moment. The campaign is still active. If people are interested and willing to donate, you can see it on Indian Collective website or Facebook page. No one should go hungry, right? And in Lakota thought and also this Indigenous people's philosophy in general, you know, food is not just a commodity. It's medicine because it comes from the earth. It's animals' life, as is plants. You know, you're taking plants' life when you harvest, and it takes energy for those plants and animals to produce the food for us to consume. And so you think about it in a holistic perspective, it's medicine. It's what you need to nourish your body, your spirit, to take care of yourself and your family, your community and your nation.
My thanks to Foster Kanoyer Hogan, a member of the NDN Collective. More at ndncollective.org.
Chigamig Gamis Kwakokag Mishizibing Aki Gabiojit Nagoyan Anishinabe Gibaba Aya Ogiwa Bandan Gagigig Owa Badangaye Gashkinadig Aki gabi ojit magoyan Owe nindakim, owe gidakim Midawe ima gichigamig Gamis kwakokag mishizibing Aki gabi ojit magoyan Kibaba aya Minziwe aking pinishimagiwen mashkodeng kiwita kaming nagam omagad aki gabi ojet magoyan. To win in an M.
That's Liz Jacala of the Fond du Lac Band. In addition to her work as a solo and choral singer, Liz is on faculty at Fond du Lac College. I met Foster Hogan and heard about his work with the Bison last month at a gathering here in Itasca County of people working for justice. It drew folks from around the country, including Nilsen Barahona, who told me this story at the dinner table.
My name is Nilsen Barahona. I'm originally from Honduras. I came to United States in 1999. I was 18 years old at that time. And I've been living here ever since that time. And on 2019, through the 287G program, I ended up being in immigration custody. It was, 2019, October. And the next year, it was like basically the beginning of the pandemic. And all the courts closed and everything got delayed. So I was able to organize with other people inside detention, hunger strike and a work strike in the detention center where we was at. After going through a period of time, when we was like fighting constantly and we was in this survival mode, trying to survive, because they didn't want to give us the stuff that we knew we needed in order to keep ourselves safe, During that pandemic, it was so hard because we could see, people dying outside in emergency rooms, that they have all the equipment and everything, to protect themselves as much as possible. And we knew that if we allowed that virus to infiltrate inside the detention center, it was going to be fatal for so many of us, So that was our fight. But at this time, my lawyers have told me that I needed to calm down when it comes to activism and organizing inside, because my story was about to be featured on the New York Times, and they wanted me to calm down, not have any type of issues until that come out, and then we see what happened. So, they told me find a way, do something that keep you, your mind off of this mode that you've been on for so long. Because at that point, I have already been fighting on Ewing County for like 7 months already. And then they transferred me to Stewart. So what I did is that basically I just started cooking to keep my mind busy. I started cooking for the people inside detention, And I started, practicing some of the stuff that I know from outside, and having an idea of ingredients and this and that to give flavor and stuff. So I will always have people around me, saying, hey, Nilsen, when you cook for yourself, tell me and I'll give you extra, and we share it, So that's how everything started. And then next thing you knew, I would have to be cooking for 10, 15 people at the same time. But one of the things that was like really popular among everybody, it was Russians, it was like there were Cubans there, Mexicans from Central America, South America. We had people from India. It was Korean, you know. There were so many people, you know, inside the tension. And it's when I talk about my people inside the tension, like sometimes it's hard for some people to grasp the idea of me talking in a very general way, you know, because we are so used to about talking about ourselves. Oh, you know, the Hispanics, you know, all the Asians, you know, the European. And the truth is that even the guards who was working in that detention center at the time, what we was doing was protecting them as well, you know? So when I said all of us, is we really have to think about all of us as a community. So you know, it was so many people from different cultures that would like to eat my food. I remember making cakes for people's birthday, you know, and the way we did the frosting, it was like, it was so creative, you know, for us. And I wish I had time to tell you every single recipe, you know, but we will have to go for a long time. So, but there is this one special event, something that happened, and that's when I was making tamales. Tamales was the thing that it was the most common for me to make, because people would order that, you know, all the time. And like I mentioned before, there has been, you know, like it was a way that we managed to get together, you know, in one feeling, everybody, you know, like, wow, we like the same type of food, you know. And it was like many Asians, you know, eating the tamales, and there was a lot of people from India eating the tamales, you know, and they would all love it. And this was a way to create community. And there was this time when I was making tamales, and I remember this guy who he has spent like almost 20 years in prison, and he was a Honduran fellow, and he was about to get deported, you know. He already paid for his time in the federal prison, but now he was on the process to get deported, right? So he came to the same unit where I was, and he was thinking that he was going to get, you know, deported right away. But what happened is that on the beginning of the year, they closed all the courts because of the pandemic. So the process, you know, they started taking longer. And not only that, you know, even those that have already their cases closed, they closed the airports as well. So, you know, so there was no flights internationally. So it was really hard. So this guy, so he thought he was leaving, right? And he didn't think of making an order. He didn't think of saying, okay, make one or two for me. But I was cooking, you know, and as I was cooking, I was basically making the masa, the dough for the tamal, and the way I was doing it, and it was like we used to buy the big bags of chips, like tortilla chips. There was the one people used to eat the nachos, and we would crush them like really hard, you know, as much as we could, and then we would put water in the microwave. And sometimes it takes like 20 minutes, you know, for a container of water to start boiling a little bit. But it was hard enough for me to pour it onto the chips and make that soft again. And now we had to be squishing it, you know, only squishing it for a long time, you know, in order to make that be a masa, you know, like it's what we needed for the tamal, the base for the tamal. And so it was a long process, you know, and sometimes I'll be honest with you. People love it so much that was the only reason why I never got in trouble. Because, you know, we only have like two or three microwaves in the unit, and other people want to cook too, you know. And you only have so much time on free time. So everybody, we have to come to the same feeling and saying, okay, we're doing this for all of us. And, you know, we're going to enjoy this. And so they will let me take over, you know, like the whole kitchen, or all of the microwaves at the same time. And so I will set everything up in the table, you know, and to create like that process, you know, like what's next on the tamal. And I remember this guy,
he would come up the top tier, right? And he would come down and look at me over the rails and kind of like getting a sense of the smell, and then go back into his cell, right? So he keep doing that back and forth every time during my whole process that I was cooking. So when I finished cooking, you know, I had all the tamales set up in the table, and I was waiting for them to cool off in order for me to start calling everybody by their name and say, okay, this is what you ordered, this is what you ordered, this is what you ordered. So when everything was already done and I was waiting for that, the guy approached me and he said, hey, brother, you know, I'm sorry, I know I didn't order anything, but, you know, will you sell me one? You know, like, I just, this is crazy the way it smells. I just want to have one. And I was like, sorry, you know, I only make tamales. They have been pre-ordered and I don't have extra. And I saw the guy walk away, but at the same time, I was like, I knew I made two extra for myself, you know? And I was like thinking like, oh my God, you know, like what happened in the tension is that you create quick and deep connections with people. It's quick because you don't know if they're going to be there the next day. They can either call your name or call their name for you to be released, for you to be deported, or for you to be sent to another detention center. So I was thinking, you know, like, what if he get moved, you know? And as I was calling everybody else, I started giving them the tamales, the order, and then I had the two left, and I was like, I'm going to make more later, so I can eat one, you know, and give him one. So I called him, and he came down really quick, you know, like, I don't want him to change his mind, but he came down really quick, and he was like, oh, what happened, brother? You know, I said, man, take this one. And he said, oh, how much I owe you? I was like, don't worry about it, you know, just eat it. Start eating it before I change my mind. So he was like, oh, thank you very much. Thank you very much. So I remember his face, you know, it's like if it's happening right now when I'm thinking about it. As he was unwrapping the tamal that he was wrapping in a plastic bag, and he could get that sense, you know, the first smell, the first, that breath that he took when he opened that tamal, I could see how his face changed, you know. And then when he took the first bite, and he started saying, brother, there is no way you make this tamal here. There is no way you make this tamal here. And he was telling me, I can taste the leaf, because back home in Honduras, we wrap the tamal in banana leaf, you know. So he was like, he was getting that connection, you know, so hard with the core of who we are through the food and through the community. Because when you eat tamal in Honduras, it's like you having a feast, you know. You having all your family there, you having your neighbors there. It's something that we share when we have parties, you know, when we have gatherings. So imagine all those flashbacks, all those memories that come to your head when you get to smell something like this without even tasting it. Once he took the first bite, tears started going down his cheek, you know, and up to this point, I didn't realize the impact that we was creating, you know, by sharing all this thing, right? All this food, all these flavors, you know, that we are so used to, you know, from back home. So he went to the phone. And I remember he was on the phone and he was screaming. He was like, Mom, you don't know what I'm eating right now. I'm eating a tamal. You have no idea. This guy is cooking this tamal just like the way you're making it back home. And so to see that, you know, it was like having an oasis, you know, in a world where it was meant to make us feel oppressed instead of feeling free. And the way we can free our souls, you know, and the way we can free our essence, you know, through the food and through the community that is created around it, is so amazing that it doesn't matter where you are, you know, you can still have that sense of belonging, like that sense of I have value, you know, and everything that I am is because of my roots and all the people that is behind me, you know.
My thanks to Nilsen Barahona. He lives in Atlanta, Georgia, where he's the coordinator of Icebreakers, working for justice and the safety of the community. Here's a serenade to an indocumentado. Tuning in to Stay Human Today. We'll be back this time next week with another hour of story and song. Today's feast featured Nilsen Barahona, Foster Cornoyan Hogan, Sam Miltich, Bernadine Jocelyn, and Dennis Goychik. I'm Michael Goldberg. Stay warm, friends, and enjoy.